All right, let's dive into this chapter on cervical radiculopathy and myelopathy from Orthopedia. You know, that fantastic, free online textbook edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet. But remember, folks, as always, before you go taking any tests or, heaven forbid, treating a patient, make sure you've actually read the book, not just listened to us chat about it.
Absolutely. Can't emphasize that enough. Reading is fundamental, as they say.
So cervical radiculopathy and myelopathy, big words. Can sound a bit intimidating. But before we get lost in the jargon, let's break it down. What are we really dealing with here? What's the common thread, and what's the key difference that we need to keep in mind?
Well, the common thread is that both involve dysfunction of the nerves in your neck. That's the big picture. But the key distinction is which part of the nervous system is affected. Radiculopathy, that's when a single nerve root, you can think of it as a branch coming off the spinal cord, is irritated or compressed. Myelopathy, on the other hand, that's when the spinal cord itself, the main highway, is compromised.
Okay, so we've got the nerve root versus the spinal cord. Now, we're Orthopedia folks, we're all about muscles, bones, joints. So why should we care about these nerve problems?
Great question. We care because often the cause of these nerve problems is a structural issue in the spine, something we can potentially diagnose and treat. So for our deep dive today, we're focusing on compression as the culprit.
Compression. So something squeezing these nerves. To understand how that happens in the neck, let's quickly review the relevant anatomy.
Right. Visualize this. You've got the brain, the control center, sending signals down the spinal cord, that superhighway of nerves. The spinal cord exits the skull through a hole called the foramen magnum and then travels down through the spinal canal, this bony tunnel formed by the vertebrae. It continues down to about the level of the first lumbar vertebra. And along the way, at each vertebral level, nerve roots branch off from the spinal cord and exit through openings called neuroforamina. These foramina are formed by the vertebral bodies in the front and the bony arches in the back, creating a protected pathway for each nerve root to head out to its destination.
So these neuroforamina, they're like little doorways for the nerve roots.
Precisely. And when we talk about cervical radiculopathy, we're talking about something compressing a nerve root as it's trying to exit through its little doorway.
Makes sense. So given that anatomy, what are the usual suspects causing that compression?
The most common culprits are problems with the intervertebral discs, those cushions between the vertebrae. You can have a disc herniation where the disc bulges out and pushes on a nerve root, or you can have bony overgrowth, these bone spurs called osteophytes, that form near the neuroforamina due to wear and tear, which we often refer to as degenerative disc disease or degenerative joint disease.
So disc problems and bone spurs. And what about myelopathy? When the spinal cord itself is compressed, what causes that?
Well, several things can narrow that spinal canal and put pressure on the cord. We can see it from large disc herniations or significant bone spurs encroaching on the canal space. Essentially, a more severe form of what we see in radiculopathy, but directed more centrally. This narrowing is what we call spinal stenosis. Then there's spondylolisthesis, which is when one vertebra slips out of alignment relative to the one below it. This misalignment can reduce the space within the canal, leading to compression. And less commonly, inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis can also contribute. The inflammation can cause overgrowth of the synovium, the lining of the facet joints, leading to slippage and narrowing of the canal.
Got it. So lots of potential culprits for squeezing those nerves. Now let's talk about the red flags. What symptoms would make you think, this could be radiculopathy?
The classic hallmark is pain that radiates in a specific pattern called a dermatome. It basically follows the map of where that particular nerve root provides sensation. So you might have pain shooting down your arm, for example. You might also see weakness in specific muscles innervated by that nerve root, numbness or tingling in the same distribution, and even decreased reflexes. The key is that it's localized, following a dermatomal pattern, unlike the more diffuse symptoms of myelopathy.
So radiculopathy is like a spotlight focused on a specific area. And how about myelopathy? How does that typically present?
Because it's the spinal cord itself that's affected, myelopathy can present in a more widespread, less specific way. Patients often describe a general stiffness or weakness, especially in their legs. They might have trouble with their balance and coordination. And you might also see subtle changes in bowel or bladder function. One characteristic symptom is Lermit's sign.
Lermit's sign, what's that?
It's a weird sensation, like an electric shock that shoots down the spine when they bend their neck forward. You might also see weakness and even muscle wasting in both the arms and legs.
Okay, let's go back to those nerve roots for a second. The chapter mentions that the relationship between the disc level and the nerve root is a bit different in the cervical spine compared to the lumbar spine. Can you un- unpack that for us. What's the naming convention?
You're right. It's important to understand this distinction. In the cervical spine, each numbered nerve root exits above the vertebra of the same number. So the C6 nerve root, for example, doesn't exit below the C6 vertebra. It exits above it, between the C5 and C6 vertebrae. This is opposite to the lumbar and thoracic spine, where the nerve root exits below the corresponding vertebra.
Okay, that makes sense for C1 through C7. But then we have the C8 nerve root, and there's no C8 vertebra. How does that fit in?
Ah, good catch. You're right. There are only 7 cervical vertebrae. The C8 nerve root is the exception. It exits below the C7 vertebra and above the first thoracic vertebra, T1. So it's sandwiched between them. That's how we end up with 8 cervical nerve roots, despite only 7 cervical vertebrae.
And that's where the naming convention switches to the lumbar pattern, with the nerve root exiting below the corresponding vertebra.
Exactly. It's all about those anatomical landmarks.
Now, are there any other key anatomical differences between cervical and lumbar nerve roots that we should be aware of?
Yes. The way they travel within the spinal canal is different. Cervical nerve roots tend to have a more horizontal course, heading straight out towards their exit point. Lumbar nerve roots, on the other hand, first take a more vertical path downward before turning laterally to exit.
And does this difference in trajectory affect how, say, a disc herniation might impact a nerve root?
Absolutely. In the cervical spine, because of that horizontal path, whether a disc herniation is central or more lateral, it's likely to compress the same nerve root at that level. So a C5, C6 disc herniation will typically affect the C6 nerve root regardless of its position. In the lumbar spine, however, it's different. A lateral disc herniation will typically compress the exiting nerve root, while a central herniation will compress the traversing root, the one exiting at the level below.
So in the lumbar spine, the location of the herniation matters more in terms of which nerve root gets affected.
Precisely. Different anatomy, different clinical implications.
Okay, let's shift gears and think about a patient walking into the clinic. What's the typical story you might hear from someone with myelopathy?
Well, they might start by complaining of neck pain or stiffness, but what will likely stand out is numbness and tingling in their limbs, and it won't necessarily follow a clear dermatomal pattern. It might be in both hands, for example, or feel more diffuse. They might also describe clumsiness with their hands, difficulty with fine motor tasks, and a general feeling of weakness, especially in their legs. Balance problems and gait instability are also common, and as things progress, they might start experiencing bowel or bladder dysfunction, which can be quite alarming.
And what would you be looking for on a physical exam to confirm your suspicions?
On exam, you might notice subtle weakness in the arms or legs, difficulty with rapid alternating movements, and impaired proprioception. Their reflexes might be exaggerated, a sign of upper motor neuron involvement, and they might have trouble walking heel to toe. We'd also check for specific signs of upper motor neuron dysfunction, like the Hoffman sign and the Babinski reflex.
Can you remind us how to elicit those signs?
Sure. For the Hoffman sign, you flick the fingernail of the patient's middle finger downward. A positive sign is when the thumb involuntarily flexes or adducts. For the Babinski reflex, you stroke the outer edge of the sole of the foot. A positive Babinski is when the big toe extends upwards, which is abnormal in adults. Remember, a positive Babinski is normal in babies under 2 months old.
So we've got the patient's story, the physical exam findings. Now, how do we correlate those with imaging? What are we looking for on those scans?
For radiculopathy, we're looking for evidence of nerve root compression at the level that corresponds to the patient's symptoms and dermatomal pattern. So if they have weakness in their deltoid and biceps and a diminished biceps reflex, suggesting C5 radiculopathy, we'd be looking at the C4, C5 level on imaging for a potential disc herniation or bony overgrowth, and so on for the other levels.
And what about imaging for cervical stenosis and myelopathy? What's the first line study?
Typically, we start with cervical x-rays. We'll get a series of views to assess the alignment of the spine, look for signs of stenosis, and check for any degenerative changes.
What do we consider stenosis on an x-ray?
Generally, absolute stenosis is defined as a spinal canal diameter of less than 10 millimeters. Relative stenosis is between 10 and 13 millimeters.
And what about CT and MRI? When are those helpful?
A CT scan can give us more detail about the bony anatomy, but it's not great for visualizing the spinal cord and nerve roots. MRI is the gold standard for that. It allows us to see the spinal cord directly, any compression, and any signal changes within the cord that might indicate myelopathy.
So MRI can give us a lot of information, but it's important to remember that not everything we see on an MRI is necessarily causing symptoms.
Exactly. We see lots of degenerative changes on MRIs, especially in older folks, that aren't causing any problems. So it's crucial to correlate the imaging findings with the patient's clinical presentation. We should never use MRI as a screening tool.
We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
All right, let's talk about treatment. What can we offer patients with these conditions?
So what about someone who has cervical stenosis on imaging, but they're feeling fine? Do we treat them?
No, if they're truly asymptomatic, we typically don't intervene. We just monitor them and educate them about potential symptoms to watch for.
And what about patients who are having symptoms? What are the non-operative options?
For mild to moderate cases, we might recommend rest, anti-inflammatories for pain and swelling, and sometimes muscle relaxants. Physical therapy can be helpful to strengthen the neck and affected limbs. For radiculopathy, we might also consider selective nerve root injections to help with pain.
And when does surgery come into play?
We typically consider surgery when symptoms are severe, progressive, or significantly impacting quality of life. The goal of surgery is to decompress the spinal cord or nerve roots. There are several different techniques, including anterior cervical discectomy and fusion, laminectomy, laminoplasty, and even prosthetic disc replacement in some cases.
Can you briefly explain the differences between those surgical approaches?
Sure. Anterior cervical discectomy and fusion, or ACDF, is a common procedure where we approach the spine from the front, remove the disc or bone spur that's causing compression, and then fuse the vertebrae together. A laminectomy involves removing a portion of the back of the vertebra to create more space for the spinal cord. Laminoplasty is a technique where we reshape the lamina, the bony arch, to widen the spinal canal. And prosthetic disc replacement is a newer option where we replace the damaged disc with an artificial one.
And how do you decide which surgical approach is best for a particular patient?
It depends on a number of factors, including the location and extent of the compression, the patient's overall health and age, and their individual preferences.
And what kind of outcomes can patients expect after surgery?
The good news is that surgery for cervical radiculopathy and myelopathy often has good success rates in terms of relieving pain and improving function. Of course, there are always risks associated with any surgery, and the recovery process can take time.
Let's wrap up by reviewing five key terms we've covered today.
Great idea. First up is radiculopathy. Remember, this is a condition affecting a nerve root in the cervical spine, causing dermatomal pain, weakness, and sensory changes.
And the second term?
Myelopathy, which involves the spinal cord itself and can lead to more widespread symptoms, including gait disturbances, bowel and bladder problems, and upper and lower extremity weakness.
What's next on our list?
C8, that extra nerve root that exits between C7 and T1. It often causes symptoms in the medial arm, fourth and fifth fingers, and intrinsic hand muscles.
The fourth term.
Spondylolisthesis, the slippage of one vertebra relative to another, which can contribute to myelopathy.
And last but not least.
Adjacent segment disease, the accelerated degeneration that can occur in the levels above and below a spinal fusion.
Fantastic. So much good stuff to remember. But remember, folks, this is just a quick chat, a taste of the knowledge. Before you go putting any of this into practice, make sure to read the full chapter in Orthopedia. We've just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.